The Author Meets the Critics. Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, where best-selling authors and their severest critics, the nation's top book reviewers, meet each other in a literary free-for-all, informal, unrehearsed, catch-as-catch-can. And I'll meet the man who keeps the peace on these programs, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. Our author today is one of the most popular columnists in the country, the two-fisted reporter for the New York World Telegram, Robert C. Ruark. Our book is Grenadine Etching, a burlesque on the historical novel, suitable, as the author himself puts it, for Hollywood, book clubs, or lighting the fire. Mr. Ruark, as you know, has a national reputation for throwing rocks at people. But this afternoon, the tables are turned. All the rock throwing for the next half hour will be at Mr. Ruark. That's the price you've got to pay, Mr. Ruark, for daring to become an author, but I'm sure that you'll have a boulder or two to heave yourself. Now, the critics are nervously pacing in their corners, but before the battle about Grenadine Etching begins, here for a short summary of his own book is our author of the afternoon, Mr. Robert C. Ruark. Mr. Ruark, what's in your book?
Everything, Mr. McCaffrey, everything. I cleaned out the closets in my head over the past year or so, and the residue became Grenadine Etching. She was born horribly one Sunday afternoon in a small hotel room and spent most of her life in similar places thereafter. There's never been anyone quite like my girl. She was born in New Orleans, which you have to do to be the heroine of a historical novel. And then she covered more ground thereafter than any three women I know of. More ground, I mean more continents, more time, more space. Everybody she met had a colorful name. She ate colorful food. She had a colorful gorilla. She had colorful children, which she lost. Or one of them drank himself to death at the age of 2 months or something. She lived in, I think, three centuries, and she was involved with people like Captain Bligh and ex-President Ulysses S. Grant, Frank Sinatra, anybody that came along. And she died happy. She died with a jug of brandy in her hand, walking up those long, twisting stairs. And I think that about sums her up.
I don't know, Mr. Ruark, whether it sums it up or not, but here are a couple of people who are going to sum up their attitudes toward your book. First, an outraged scholar, the hard-to-please professor of classics, Mr. Eugene O'Neill, Jr.
I take a Queen Victoria attitude, Mr. McCaffrey.
Mr. O'Neill, you're opposed to the bustle?
Nor am I opposed on the moral grounds on which one might very well be opposed to this book, but that's not my line of criticism at all. I just would like to paraphrase a famous remark of Queen Victoria: we are not amused.
Well, you can't say anything worse about a book that's supposed to be funny. I have little notes down here on how I should introduce people, because even Mr. Miller and Mr. O'Neill, whom I know so well and have had so often on this program, I had down a Princeton professor, Mr. O'Neill. That would be a horrible thing.
Oh, that's
you
true
are a
right now.
That's right. Yeah. You are a Princeton professor. True. Now, excuse me. I was all mixed up between Yale and Princeton. They get mixed up so easily these Saturdays. Well, there, Mr. Ruark, is your opposition. In your own defense, we have an experienced opponent for Mr. O'Neill, an editor of Harper's Magazine, Mr. Merle Miller.
Well, I think it ought to be explained, probably, that Mr. O'Neill is a professor, I believe, of Greek, and he hasn't laughed at anything written since, well, the 2nd century B.C. I'm somewhat easier to please. I might add, first of all, I was very favorably disposed toward this book. I had just been reading that longest and certainly the dullest book of the 20th century, Mr. Ben Ames Williams' House Divided. I also was so unfortunate all about 3 years ago to read Miss Kathleen Windsor's most persuasive argument against learning how to read, Forever Amber. I like a number of things about Mr. Ruark's book. I think it's funny. It made me laugh. I could lift it with one hand without straining a muscle. Incidentally, I don't want to go back a moment. I'm a little unkind to Mr. Williams' book. It does have some purpose. I think if you had a small boy in the house, he could learn how to chin himself on it. But I laughed about, on an average of once every 10 pages of Mr. Ruark's book, and that's going a long ways these days. I'm delighted that it's only 270 pages long. I'm delighted that he wrote it.
Well, my idea of a good, amusing book, Mr. Miller, is certainly one which scores laughs at a somewhat better rate than that. As a matter of fact, I think I probably laughed a couple of times during the book, but I rather expect a really funny book to make me laugh on practically every page, and some of the things written before the 2nd century B.C. that you refer to do make one laugh in practically every line, and that's my notion of comedy.
Well, I don't know. Take this, Mr. O'Neill, just to put you directly on the spot. Here's something from page 2. You don't even have to have gone 10 pages. The initial opening character, a doctor, speaks this way. He says, "The old absinthe house is a place where the gayest desperados of New Orleans sported. This morning I asked for my usual morning libation, a concoction of gin, absinthe, and bourbon whiskey, into which I dropped a drug of my own invention." Then there's a footnote, and it says, "Benzedrine." I think that's very funny.
I'm afraid I don't, somehow, and I think that leads into the main criticism that I have of this book, which is that it tries too hard to be funny. And I feel the huffing and puffing and blowing and grunting of the author in an effort to make me laugh. And instead, I feel merely pained and, quite frankly, rather embarrassed for the author.
I liked a number of things about the book, and they did make me laugh. For example, I liked all those few pages that talk about modern advertising. Shades of Frederick the Saxon Charm and Huckster's Wakeman. That made me laugh. I like those parts.
Picking an awfully dim shade there, Mr. Miller, but go ahead.
And also a rather unhistorical novel, generally speaking.
I think we've already heard from the author on this. He says he threw in everything up to and including the kitchen sink, so he threw in Mr. Wakeman. He also threw in a man who shall be nameless, but who's named, his last name is Wilson. His first name is Edmund, and some people say, quote, Bunny, unquote, Wilson, who wrote a book, the dirtiest, and I think one of the worst books, not as bad as Mr. Williams. You have to work hard to get that bad. But he wrote a book called Memoirs of Hecate County, in which there were about 5 pages in French. Well, now, I can't read French. I don't know, maybe Mr. Wilson can. But I like the fact that a couple of characters in Grenadine, were written in French. This, I thought, was funny. Made me laugh. Well, we could also mention a few parodies on Mr. William. I'm still a child prodigy at nearly 40, Sir Ryan. I thought that was funny. See, you've got everything.
That's right. You should even have something from
Mr. O'Neill, although apparently not. No Euripides.
No, not very much. And as a matter of fact, when you call in the matter of bringing in foreign languages, one of the most respected novels written in the 20th century, The Magic Mountain of Thomas Mann, has very long sections, not just a few pages, which are written in French, and I've never heard anybody who felt outraged by those. My feeling is
now you
that if you
somebody.
Can't
I
read...
I just want to be on the record, I'm outraged. Go ahead now.
If you can't read French, you shouldn't be reading decent literature, is about the way I feel about it.
Well, I might also confess, this is a dreadful thing to say, but I can't read Euripides in the original. I realize that probably makes... Well, what does that make of one, Mr. O'Neill? Could you think of a nice, polite word suitable for radio?
Yes, it means that you have a little Latin and less Greek. That's the quote, incidentally.
Another thing I liked about Grenadine, at the age of, whenever children start talking, Grenadine uttered her first word, and her first word, of course, was man. And then at the age of two, she was singing in a very lovely, deep contralto, and she was born, I might add, with silver hair. Stop me if you've heard that before. With silver hair which reached to her shoulder blades. Well, you can see this young woman combines all of the, I can't say virtues, can I? That wouldn't be accurate. But all of the characteristics, shall we say, both physical and mental, of all the historical novels that have ever been written. At least all the bad ones.
Mr. Miller, if you were a classicist, you could say virtues, because the original meaning of virtue was specific excellence. And I think with respect to a dame such as Grenadine, this is one of her specific excellences.
Now, just a minute, Mr. O'Neill. This is a perfectly respectable program, and I don't want you going on calling people dames. Let's be literary here, for heaven's sake. Keep this on a high plane. I I feel, however, that that Mr. Miller is doing a magnificent job of defending the virtue and or virtues of grenadine etching, but I feel that probably a man who has known her and loved her for a long time, she is his creation. He can speak so lovingly of her, I am sure, because, well, principally she's making him a lot of money. So I think that it's time now to hear from our author of the afternoon, the author of Grenadine Etching, Mr. Robert C. Ruark.
Well, Mr. McCaffrey, after supporting a woman so long, it's nice to be supported by one. I want to take some small exception to Mr. O'Neill on this huffing and the puffing and the blowing of the author. I'd like to tell him how this book was written. Due to a drug of my own invention, which starts with B and it doesn't mean Benzedrine, I would sit down in front of this typewriter and entirely unconscious of what I was doing, I would come to 3 hours later with 20 pages of double-spaced neat copy. And after 3 months of that, I had a book. There were no huffs, no puffs, and no visible effort to the writing. As a matter of fact, I don't think I wrote it. I think somebody else wrote it.
Now, this opens up an entirely new field for the production of books, which Doubleday and Company must be very much interested in.
Well, as a matter of fact, Mr. Ruark, if I were you, I would prefer that somebody else had written it.
Well,
I'm ready to excuse you, but I still condemn the book.
Well, you condemn it as decent literature. Whoever pretended that this was decent literature.
There you go.
No, I condemn it, quite frankly, as humor, because I think it's dull, and I think it's overdone, and I'm going to read an example which I think illustrates what I'm getting at.
Is this a long example?
No, it is very short.
Good.
But I want to preface it with this point, that I think that practically any would-be humorist in a prep school magazine can do better than this. The lawyers came in, drew up the papers in a trice, and they were signed and witnessed. The papers, not the lawyers. Boy, oh boy, is that funny. Wow. Putting the trice back in their briefcases. Oh, you're so cute, Mr. Ruark.
No,
you're kidding. They hurriedly went away to sit in on an auction of recently excavated torts.
I would like, Mr. McCaffrey, with your permission, to... Well, of course, did I say there was a laugh every 10 pages? As Mr. O'Neill goes on, and I mean on and on, I begin to think the book is much funnier than I thought so in the first place. I'd like to, just a very short, even shorter than Mr. O'Neill's passage, to read a passage about cigarette advertising. Can I do that, Mr.
Yes,
McCaffrey?
Yes, you can. I've even reached for the book myself, if everybody's going to read.
By sheer repetition, it says here, this woman, I don't know whether we mentioned this or not, maybe we did, she invented the cigarette and also, God bless her, cigarette advertising. And so it says here on page 238, by sheer repetition, grenadine convinced the American public that you could drive a cigarette to work, you could enjoy it on a surfboard, you could wear it instead of clothes, you could relieve sinus with it, you could substitute it for your ordinary everyday opium and employ it in lieu of a fountain pen to write Pulitzer Prize-winning plays. I think that's kind of funny. Made me laugh a little bit.
I think it's overdone.
Well,
I think.
How about
this
chapter 21, Mr. Ruark? I want to prove you're funny, too. Here, this wonderful chapter called Mattress Poisoning. I believe that was induced by the fact that you opened that chapter by saying when Grenadine turned 40, she liked to die. Well, we went into the whole business of her getting to be 40, and then the next chapter for Mattress Poisoning, the next chapter is Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. And the chapter, that's all that's in the chapter is, I just know it'll fly, boys, Grenadine said.
Could I say another thing, Mr. McCaffrey?
Everybody talks but me. Go ahead.
Sorry.
I'm supposed to be a moderator, Mr. Ruark. Now I'll be one and I'll let you talk.
I was just saying that the degree of dullness that one finds in a book, I think, is absolutely predicated on the degree of dullness in the reader.
That, I think, if you had written your book on the level of that crack, Mr. Ruark, it would be an amusing book.
Mr. Miller.
I'd just like to get down seriously to talk a little bit about the idea of humor. I'm getting a little fed up these days with the idea that all the funny men in the world, particularly all the funny men in the United States, write for the New Yorker. I don't believe it. Now, I don't think the New Yorker would ever print any part of Grenadine Etching, and I'm kind of glad about that because I think the New Yorker humor like the New Yorker short stories for the most part, have become so studied, so much of a pattern, so delightfully obscure, that I must say I don't read it as much as I used to, or maybe eventually I won't read it at all anymore. Well, here's something that's kind of new in the way of humor. It's very broad, very thick satire. Well, I'm for very broad, thick satire these days. I wish we had more of it.
What's the trouble? Does the subtle kind elude you, Mr. Miller, or are you weary of it all?
Somewhat weary of it all, Mr. O'Neill.
In other words, you're escaping into primitivism or something of that sort.
I resent that. We didn't go back.
Well, now look, now you can't resent that, Mr. Ruark, the escape into primitivism. After all, what about the gorilla? And after all, Grenadine ran around with a gorilla. Now, lots
Possibly.
Of girls in Chicago ran around with gorillas, too, but they've never been put in historical novels.
If I just had the book, I would quote from it. This gorilla, at one time, wore a satin cloak with a red lining, spats on its spatulate feet, I remember that, and was smoking big cigars. A very advanced gorilla. She was also psychoanalyzed at the age of 14. How advanced can you get?
Well, for a gorilla, that's pretty good, but I still say that is, at best, a more or less advanced form of what is still, I say, primitivism.
Well, now, you see, there's one thing I ought to mention. I went at this book with kind of a liking for Mr. Ruark. I mean, you do let the writer's personality get into even fiction. For example, if I were to read a book by Mr. O'Neill, I would go at it in a slightly different way. But I thought I was going to like this book because I like what Mr. Ruark has done, something we haven't mentioned. He did a big takeoff on a general way over there. He used to be. He isn't anymore, thank heaven. Way over there in Italy, whose name I think it's an obscure name, but I believe it was something like L.E.E.
It once stood for a very good general.
Yes. And as an enlisted man who once had the misfortune during the war to come under the jurisdiction of General L.E.E., I like what Mr. Ruark has been writing in his daily newspaper column about this ex-general, soon to be retired, I believe.
I think he's already quit, hasn't he?
Thank you very much, Mr. Ruark.
I still think, however, that what you write in a daily newspaper column and what you write in a book are, to some extent, different things. A daily newspaper column, you don't have to take quite so much of it. I mean, a man can stand almost anything from the top to the bottom of a column, but
and
for
279
pages of this sort of stuff, it's something else again. I think it's unforgivable, quite frankly.
You see, Mr. O'Neill is really very mixed up. This book really has only 270 pages. Where did you get the other nine, Mr. O'Neill?
It must have been the impression. As a matter of fact, I was cutting in half what I felt was the length of the book.
Well, Mr. Ruark, I am interested in some of your writing processes. Your initial description of it fascinated me so much. Would you care to go into the reasons why you wrote this book? That is, aside from paying for the analyst. I'm sure that a good deal of it was, well, I've been on this couch paying him. Why don't I turn some of this stuff over into my own? But aside from that, was there any purpose? Would you have a really grim moral determination to do something good for the world in
Yes.
writing Grenadine Etching?
Yes, Mr. McCaffrey. I hope to put the historical novel completely out of business for all time.
How do your publishers feel about that?
They are sort of unwilling accessories before the fact here. They have to eat.
I'd like to comment here, if I might, that I think that's a very worthy aim. But quite frankly, I think that the books that you parody are a great deal funnier than the parody of them that you have written.
It's very difficult to caricature a caricature, Mr. O'Neill.
Granted. It's extremely difficult. I think your book proves that fairly well.
Touché, well, as the man said before.
Aside from this book being funny, and everyone has their own attitude toward that, there are even attitudes in the audience already about whether they think this is or is going to be a funny book. Mr. Miller, do you think that it is a valid commentary on the historical novel?
Oh, I most assuredly do. You see, I don't read for pleasure anymore. I only read when I get paid for it. And unfortunately, about twice a week, somebody sends me for review. You make a very small amount of money doing this, in case anybody's interested. You get this huge package in the mail, and you lug it upstairs. I live four floors up. Your back is tired, your arms are tired, and you sit down, and like Mr. Ruark, if you're smart, if you're intelligent, you bring out a bottle of something that begins with B, but we shan't spell the rest of it. And you start reading this historical novel. I dare say I have read, during the last year, about 12 of them. I haven't read a good one, with one exception, one good one, plug. a book by a man named A.B. Guthrie called The Big Sky. Well, now, there was an historical novel which had real genius about it, I think. But the other 11, and the 11 I read must have been, of 100 or 110, were all unbelievably bad. Now, if millions of people can read this book so that they can never again take seriously that long hoopla which is published all too often these days, I will be even more grateful to Mr. Rourke than I am at this moment.
If that eventuality, that blessed consummation comes about, I should also be grateful to Mr. Rourke and be inclined to forgive him for much that I would otherwise regard as unforgivable.
I'm a little worried about Mr. O'Neill's last remark because for the first time in several programs, I find myself in agreement with him. There must be something wrong with my point of view.
Yeah, possibly with mine, however, you know, that always could
be. You're softening him up.
This is revolutionary. Don't get over the edge, Mr. O'Neill.
As a matter of fact, I'm going over the edge sufficiently because I'm going to cite a passage from this book that I like. And a very good remark which says, a salad without garlic is like kissing a man without a mustache. Now, I can see, Mr. Rourke.
I might say to
let me finish, yes, Mr.
Sure,
McCaffrey. This is meant to be a good remark now. Don't break in on it,
sorry,
please.
Sorry.
I can see why you said that, but I would say like kissing a man without a beard, if you don't mind.
Yes. Well, I think that illustrates my point about the dullness of relationship. I thought that was a very dull thing. It's one of the oldest cliches in the world, and I was kidding the cliche at the time. You see, what appeals to this man's mentality?
No. It appealed to me because of its incompleteness, and I thought you were being very subtle, because the usual remark is, if you haven't kissed a man without a beard, you don't know what it is to be kissed. That's the cliche that I was brought up on and encouraged by, let us say.
I might say that for our radio audience that we will take a vote among our studio audience immediately after this broadcast about the sensations of mustaches and beards. Mr. Rourke having a mustache and Mr. O'Neill having both a mustache and a beard. We will get a vote on it and give it to you in our next program. And if anyone wants to carry out any experimentation along these lines, they all know where they can get both Mr. O'Neill and Mr. Rourke.
Well, as the only man in, at least up here today, except Mr. McCaffrey, who doesn't count since he's moderator, as the only smooth-faced man in up here sitting around this table, I'd like to say that it seems to me probably the reason Mr. O'Neill thought that remark was funny, which I didn't either, I agree with Mr. Rourke, was because he never read, lucky man, Gone with the Wind. Did you ever read Gone with the Wind, Mr. O'Neill?
I tried.
Congratulations.
No Greek edition out?
No, so far as I know, there's a Greek translation underway, but it's expected to be published in 2756.
Thank heaven. When everyone will, of course, be able to handle Greek.
We hope.
Well, now, let's get back to the historical novel that's being caricatured here. You've called it a lot of hoopla, Mr. Miller. Obviously, Mr. Rourke doesn't like it, but just as obviously, hundreds of thousands, and in some cases millions of people, do like them. What do they like about them?
Well, lots of people go to the movies once a week, too. Good heavens, I don't know why. I mean, I'm not a student of psychology. Why anybody would go to the movies to see an historical novel? Not once, but apparently they're now reviving them. I mean, it wasn't bad enough if you had to look at it 5 years ago. You have to look at it a second time if you walked on Broadway. Why do people do this? I don't know. Apparently people, I would guess, want to escape from the horrible realities in which we now live. Is that's a very serious
Yes,
idea, but I think maybe that's true.
I think some of our smaller magazines so constantly illustrate in a backhanded way those horrible realities that almost anyone would find a necessity to escape. Would you like to be specific,
Mr. McCaffrey? If you're speaking of that brilliantly edited, that eminently readable, that always available magazine, Harper's, I think you're quite wrong. I think we're one of the wittiest magazines now being published.
I think you're very funny. Thank you. Mr. Rourke, do you want to make any remarks about the historical novels you have read or not read? Did you read any historical novels before writing Grenadine Etching?
No, my wife had been bad for some time, so for punishment I made her read them all and digest them for me.
So actually this is the result of not knowing anything about the historical novel.
Well, I was exposed to Amber one time. It was the only book on Guam at the moment. You get tired of reading reports.
Well, did you read, Mr. Rourke, did you ever read Wakeman? Have you read Saroyan? Have you read all these? And have you ever listened to Norman Corwin on the air? I mention that because here in the last part, There is the best parody I have ever seen for what a lot of people take seriously, these radio dialogues of Mr. Norman Corwin. I thought that was Did you knowingly try to make all of these funny?
I did indeed.
I think you did.
I did indeed. I heard Mr. Corwin one time. I had a broken leg, and somebody cut the radio on, and I had to sit there through one of those escapes into triumph routines.
It seems to me that perhaps not so much for your particular technique from Norman Corwin. That's a little out of your line. But I do think that for what you're trying to do, you might have learned quite a lot from the virtue of restraint as practiced by some of your predecessors. I'm thinking of Lardner, for example, and also of Damon Runyon. And I think you could learn quite a lot in the art of parody from reading Billy Rose, which you can do almost any time. And a less well-known man I would recommend to your reading is Wallace Smith. There are a lot of others, too. But those people seem to me to have the gift of humor by understatement, by not pushing, by not trying to make a man laugh with a sledgehammer. I don't laugh when I'm hit over the head with a sledgehammer, and that's the feeling that I have with most of your sentences, Mr. Rowan.
Were you hit over the head with a sledgehammer at any
time? As a child.
No, I've hit wedges and so on plenty of times myself with a sledgehammer, but I never happened to have been hit with one myself. But,
you mean telling me, Mr. O'Neill, that neither Bobby Clark nor Bert Lahr can make you laugh?
Yes, they can make me laugh, I don't think that's the sledgehammer technique either. I think there's a good deal of subtlety there.
Not very much understatement.
No, but I don't think there is also overstatement either. And I mean, that, again, is a different kind of comedy because I think what makes you laugh about those people is watching them. I don't think they would make me laugh just listening to them. I never happen to have heard either one on the radio, but I can't imagine that they would be particularly funny merely being listened to.
Well, this will really surprise you, Mr. O'Neill. I'd like to agree at least a little bit with what you've said. I don't think that Mr. Ruark yet is as funny as, well, for example, Mr. Ring Lardner, who I think is probably one of the funniest men who's been around for, 100 years or so. And I have one small criticism of the book, maybe not so small. I think all books...
Turncoat?
sorry, Mr. Ruark, in honesty. I think every book needs a good editor. And I think a good editor on Mr. Ruark's book would have cut it somewhat. Even though it's only 270 pages long, I think there are parts that might have come out. But I don't blame the author for that. I blame the publisher. I blame whoever it happened to be who edited the book. Although, of course, it's quite possible that if any golden word was attempted to be taken out, Mr. Ruark might have screamed like an author. I don't know. But I think the editor should have been strong-minded enough to make it, about 150 pages would have pleased me more.
Mr. Miller, you as an editor should know better than that. Editors are people that you recognize just like catchers in baseball. Their fingers are all gnarled and broken from trying to take out words from authors' books, and then a hammer is hit over their fingers, you see. You can't tell them from a backstop anytime.
It somehow seems to me that an author who's worthy of the name ought to be able to do a little self-criticism, ought to be able to edit himself.
Well, now hold on for a second.
Practically speaking, authors are going to do everything but write pretty soon. In the old days, certainly, an author was expected to turn out his work finished as he wanted it, without any need of editorial assistance. He was expected to be able to criticize himself and take out what shouldn't be there.
Well, and so we have the novel of Mr. Walter Scott. There you are, Mr. Ruark.
Well, the professor says that I should have had more discipline. Personally, I thought it was a great book. I liked every word of it. It killed me. It would have murdered me if anybody had tampered with it, you see.
Well, we've only tampered with it slightly, Mr. Ruark, and here is Bob Sherry now to give you a preview of our next book on The Author Meets the Critics.
Next week, another hard-hitting reporter is put on the spot when Colonel Robert S. Allen of Washington Merry-Go-Round fame comes to our microphone to defend his new book, Lucky Forward. Lucky Forward is a typical Bob Allen book. Written at fever heat, it pulls no punches as a story of incompetence, jealousy, and stupidity on the Battle of the Bulge. Be sure to listen next Sunday when author Robert S. Allen meets guest critic Henry J. Taylor in A Battle About a Battle. And now a final word from John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Mr. Robert C. Ruark for coming here to discuss his new book, Grenadine Etching, and to thank you, Mr. Eugene O'Neill, Jr., and you, Mr. Merle Miller, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone, directed by Clay Daniel. This is Bob Cherry speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
WNBC, New York. It is now 5 p.m.